Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals the hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. Take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. It's my pleasure to be here. We've got JB and Kirk this evening. And also, as my trusty U.S. associate, we have Asher at my feet trying to chew on everything in sight. JB, you informed me of something that I was unaware of. And I think we need to share it with our audience regarding Stephen, who runs the Yada Yada YouTube channel.
Yeah, I've had several people email me over the last few weeks asking because that had been updated, and I don't have a contact form. I think I've talked to him a few times in the chat room here, but that's about it. But Mike, a good friend of mine, was able to get a hold of him and found out he's actually been in the hospital for over a month now with a pretty severe case of pneumonia. So.
Well, if you're in the hospital that long with pneumonia, it's a severe case.
Yeah.
You know, I find that so many of the people that I am introduced to,
the ones that had a falling out with you over the David thing, and I'm assuming that's not the case, so.
Yeah, I find it's that more often than not, when I'm introduced to somebody for the first time, then they will Google my name, or just Google Yada Yada. They end up at the Yada Yada YouTube channel, and they watch the videos that he's posted of our program. So lots and lots of people view them, and he makes a tremendous impact by doing it. And as part of the Covenant family, we wish Stephen a swift recovery from what's got to be a terrible ordeal. We were last week on Mizmor, Lyrics to the Psalms, 132:10. And it basically says, on behalf of Dode, your associate and co-worker, never remove your presence from your anointed. And while one might make an argument that the anointed here is Yahusha, it certainly doesn't meet name Yahusha. And even if the anointed is Yahusha and not Dode, who's the only one that's named, then it's interesting that he would talk about Yahusha being for the benefit of Dode, or on behalf of Dode, that Yahusha was on account of Dode. That is really a fascinating concept. I was also, Lisa sent me a statement from 2 Kings, the 22nd chapter, and it was speaking of the influence of Dode and Yahweh's view of Dode. And this is really interesting. Let me just share it briefly. This is not a researched translation. It's just quick. Yoshiya was 8 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Yah Dida, which would be the beloved of Yah, the daughter of Abiyah. And he did that which was right, that which was correct in the sight of Yahweh. And he walked all the way of Dod. And he did not turn aside to the right or to the left. Isn't that interesting? What is being said is that he didn't walk in the way of didn't name anybody other than not Adam, not Noah, not Abraham, not Yitzhak, not Jacob, not Moshe. He walked in the way of Dod, his father, and he turned not aside to the right or to the left. Steadfast. You know, this path is narrow. And it came to pass in the 18th year of King Josiah that the king sent Shaphan, the son of Axelah, the son of Musalam, the scribe, to the house of Yahweh. By the way, it doesn't say temple, doesn't say shrine, doesn't say religious center. It's the house, because of the covenant. The house of Yahweh, say. Go up to Chilkiah, the high priest, that he may and deliver that which is brought to the house of Yahweh, which the keepers of the door have gathered of the people. And let them deliver it into the hand of the doers, those who engage and accept the work, and that have the oversight of the house of Yahweh. And let him give it to those who engage and act in the work of Yahweh, in the house of Yahweh, to repair the breaches in the house, to the carpenters and to the builders and to the masons, and to buy timber and hewn stone to repair the house. Howbeit, there was no reckoning made with them of the sum of money, and it was delivered unto the hand because they dealt faithfully. And Chilkiah, the high priest, said unto Shaphan the scribe, I have found the book of the Torah in the house of Yahweh. And Chilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, and he read it. And Shaphan the scribe came to the king and brought the king's the word again, and also said, your servants have gathered the money that was found in the house, and they delivered it into the hand of them that engage and act upon the work, and that have oversight of the house of Yahweh. And Shaphan the scribe showed the king Chilkiah, the priest, hath delivered a book to me. And Shaphan read it before the king. And it came to pass that when the king had heard the words of the book of the Torah, he rent his house. And the king commanded Chilkiah the priest, and Akham the son of Shaphan, and Abkor the son of Micaiah, and Shaphan the scribe, and Ashiah a servant of the king, saying, go, you, inquire of Yahweh for me, and for the people, and for all of Yahudah concerning the words of this book that is found. For great is the disappointment of Yahweh that is kindled against us, because our fathers have not listened to the words of this book and do not act according to all that is written concerning us. So Chilkiah the priest, and Akham the, and Akor, and Shaphan, and Ashiah went unto Kulda, the prophetess, the wife of Sulam, the son of Tikwa, the son of Caucus, keeper of the wardrobe. And now she dealt in Jerusalem, in the college, and they communicated with her. And she said unto them, by the way, it's just interesting now, here are all these big shot boys. They went to the girl. And she said unto them, thus says Yahweh, Elohim of Yisrael, tell a man that sent you to me. Thus says Yahweh, behold, pay attention. will bring evil upon this place, and upon all the inhabitants thereof, even all the words of the book, which the king of Yehuda has read. Because they have forsaken, they have separated from me. They have abandoned me. And they have burned incense to other Elohim, that they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. And therefore, my wrath shall be kindled against this place, and it shall not be quenched. God, no wonder God is so disappointed with his people. But to the king of Yehuda, who sent you to inquire, thus saith to him Yahweh, Elohim of Yisrael, says that the words which you have heard, because your heart was open and receptive, and you have inclined yourself toward Yahweh, when you hearest what I spoke against this place and against the inhabitants thereof, that they should become a desolation and a curse, and you have rent your clothes and wept before me, I have also heard what you say to Yahweh. Behold, therefore, I will gather you unto your fathers, and you shall be gathered unto your grave in peace. Shalom, reconciled. And your eyes shall not see all of the evil which I will bring upon this place. And they brought the king the word again. Boy, I tell you what, as I translate Yashaya 17, I haven't done that now in probably 3 years, but it's the second to last chapter of Observations for Our Time, because I'm going through Isaiah, and I've finally come to the 17th chapter, and so I'm redoing it, and you witness here this setup, and I'm right now at the, I guess it's the 12th verse of the 17th chapter. And prior to this, we've been presented with the fall of Damascus and the becoming a twisted heap of ruin. And we come to understand what Damascus represents. It's the place where Pauline Christianity was born. It's the place that the world is now focused in terms of world war, where you've got the United States and Europe and on one side, and China and Russia on the other. It's a place where the two branches of Islam, Sunni and Shia, are in mortal combat to the death. And how it's going to come a twisted heap of ruins, and the Syrian government's going to fall, and as a result, the world's going to capitulate and narrow Israel at the waist, where 70% of the population live, she becomes indefensible. And then it talks about the fulfillment of Teruah and a very specific harvest, and delineates the number of people that are going to be harvested at that time and where they're going to come from. And it's really profound. And it goes on to where I am now, where once it's explained who's harvested and who's left, why certain people are left and others are taken at this time. There's this presentation of this flood of Islamic terrorists into Israel, the unstoppable, damning, destructive flood that leaves the whole place lifeless and desolate. And in the midst of this, there were some words that, the first time through I just missed. But one of the verbs that talk about what's going to transpire is the basis of Shaul and Sheol. She says you're literally going to be living in hell on earth. And then Sheol is actually depicted. And you know how I've just assumed, because it seemed natural, that Sheol would be akin to a black hole, a lightless place where nothing escapes, infinite in time. And it just seemed like that would be the perfect metaphor for what Sheol represents in our universe. Well, son of a gun, first time I've ever noticed it. field is actually described. And it says that it's a black hole, a dark and lightless place of enormous pressure, a depression, and that's really what a black hole is. It's a depression in space-time where nothing escapes.
What verse is this?
That would be, it's in 1712.
Okay.
And I will...
I wanted to make sure.
Yeah, 1712. I'm right now on page 50 of my rewrite of the chapter. I think it was 50 pages when I started. It's now 72 pages because I'm adding a lot to it, and I've got a lot more to go. And what I'm redoing is I'm redoing every translation and then augmenting the insights into each of the words. But the particular word that I'm talking about is Shaon. You know, it's the basis of Shaul and Sheol. But the own at the end, which, you know, is used like in Shabbaton and those sorts of words. There's four or five words that use the own ending at the end. And this is essentially Sheol with the own ending at the end. So everything to do with, if you will, Sheol. So it's a hellish place. But anyway, I'll send that out because, I kind of probably should wait till I finish it because, you know, to send a chapter that's two-thirds done and one-third not done is probably pretty silly, but... if you guys want to at least have a chance to go over it, it would be really pertinent, I think, if we take a break from kind of what we're doing and we return to Yashayahu 17 and talk about how it sets up the timeline for what's going to transpire over the next, I'll say 10 years.
Please do, yeah.
Yes. So this begins. Or this doesn't begin, but where we're picking up is on behalf of Dod. That's an interesting thing. You know, this is a Psalm 132:10. On behalf of Dod, for the benefit of Dod, your associate and co-worker. What's interesting, too, is that, you know, the guy, he's only known as David. If you tell somebody, you know, we're together, we're so impressed with this Dod, they'd have look at you with snake eyes and have no clue what you're talking about. You know that the name is written like 600-700 times to our prophets and Psalms. You know how many times there's the id, so that you could, so say you corrupted the wall and you had no idea what the wall in the middle, because it's DWD, and you had no idea what the wall was, and you said, okay, I'm going to make that da, just for giggles, as opposed to do. You know how many places where they have a vowel representing the I, which would be the yod here, of the, I think it's, let's say, 700-800 times that it's in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. How many of those could you misconstrue to be Dawid or Dawid as opposed to Dod?
I mean, most of them corrupted.
One.
I haven't seen one.
Yeah, there's one.
I haven't seen any.
Some obscure place, there's one in the Masoretic text. So how in the world they get that, I have absolutely no clue. By the way, for those who communicate with Stephen, that are in the chat room, if you know Stephen's email, why don't you post it in the chat room so that others of us can look it up. So never remove your presence from your anointed. Well, we know that Dod was anointed, so... it just reads straightforward. On behalf of Dod, your associate and co-worker, never remove your presence from your anointed. That's what Dod wanted. I want to be in the presence of Yahweh. We all do. And Dod is acknowledging that he's the one that Yahweh declared to be set apart, prepared, and shown to be authorized and approved for a particular leadership role and an important function through the application of olive oil, symbolizing the set-apart spirit. Now, as we've come to realize, Mashiach is either an adjective or a verb, but it's never a proper noun, and thus it cannot be a title. And even if it were a title, it is used in reference to a number of people, and with none more often than don't. Mashiach is used to affirm that a person has been chosen and prepared, authorized and approved, to work as an agent or to complete a particular mission. The means to this end is often, but not exclusively, a small application of olive oil, the symbol of the Spirit. But to ignore the fact that many were anointed, including the pagan king Cyrus, and pretend that the term applies exclusively to Jesus, or even that it was a title, much less a significant designation, is ignorant. There is little of any justification for calling Yahusha, much less Jesus, HaMashiach, or the Messiah. And the notion that he was the Christ is as preposterous as calling him Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. There is no such person. Dod, however, was Yahweh's Mashiach, delivered or derived from the verb Mashiach, meaning to apply olive oil. It was an adjective and used to affirm that God had declared him to be set apart and to be properly prepared. By using it, Yah is saying and demonstrating that he had authorized and approved him for a specific leadership role and for a particular and important function. When we consider God's sworn oath, we are confronted by one of the most troubling aspects of Christianity, even Islam, if it is to be taken seriously. Both require God to renege on his promises and therefore to be a liar. This presumption begs the question, why would God lie? Why would anyone trust a dishonest deity? And why haven't more Christians and Muslims come to their senses and realize that Paul and Muhammad promoted their religion by projecting their dishonest nature on the God they created? And God's not going to change. He will never accept, much less inspire, a New Testament, a Talmud, or a Quran. These are man's attempts to change the nature of God, not God's attempt to change what he has already communicated. You know, I was having lunch today, and we were just talking about the Talmud and why it isn't appropriate to ask a religious Jew. Since the Torah was clearly inspired by God, what's the purpose of the Talmud? Since the Torah and the prophets and the Psalms all proved their prophecy that they came from Yahweh, why would you replace it with a book that was obviously written by men? Since the Talmud and the Torah differ, how is it possible that the Talmud, which claims to be an oral Torah, could be from a trustworthy God?
Or to the Roman Catholic. You can contradict yourself.
Correct.
Right,
yeah.
There, out the window.
No answer to those questions. Or to the Roman Catholic. Why do you worship a dead God on a stick? What in the world is wrong with you? Yahweh swore an oath. He affirmed the truth, solemnly swearing, while confirming the promises associated with seven. This is Shabbat. Yahweh swore an oath. Yahweh doesn't have much wiggle room. You know, he says God can do whatever he wants, so he can't. Well, I guess he can do whatever he wants, because the only thing he wants to do is to be steadfast, trustworthy, reliable, father of the covenant. So he can do what he wants in that sense.
Yeah.
But he won't. He's very limited in what he actually can do.
Yeah.
Because he did swear an oath. It's a binding oath. That's why Dod is so matter of fact when he says, you can't keep me out of spiritual
realm. I got the Torah right here in my hand.
I've got the Torah right here in my hand.
Right.
So, I'm coming.
One of my favorite lines.
Yahweh swore an oath. Now, which is interesting, he swore an oath bestowed.
Yeah. Cool.
Now, how many people do you think Yah was swore an oath to?
Not many.
Not many. Yahweh swore an oath to Dode. That makes Dode really important, doesn't it? If God is swearing an oath to you, you are really, 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 really important.
That's a big deal.
Yes. That's a big deal. He ain't swearing an oath to me, I guarantee you that. I'm fortunate just to be able to read what he said to those he inspired. Yahweh swore an oath to Dode, which is trustworthy and reliable. Well, that means that the testimony Dode revealed based upon the inspiration Yahweh provided is trustworthy and reliable. Emeth.
Yeah.
It's honest and true, certain and sure, dependable and enduring. He will not change it nor turn away from it. Shub min he. He will not go back or create a second variation of it. That destroys Christianity, and the Christian New Testament destroys the concept of Islam and the Quran. It destroys the basis of Judaism, which is the Talmud. He's trustworthy and reliable. He will not change it nor turn away from it. There is no gospel of faith. There is no new covenant. There's no religion of Christianity. That which comes from the fruit of your innermost being, I will place upon your seat of honor. Well, who's innermost being?
Toads.
Whose heart's desire? Whose passion? Whose mental... Toads?
Toads.
That which comes from the fruit, the valued harvest, that which is results from what you're doing, of your innermost being, betanat, of your heart's desire and passion, even your mental faculties, I will place upon your seat of honor. Well, are you going to put an apple on the seat of honor? This is Dode's seat of honor. This is the best seat in the house. This is the seat right next to Yahweh. Talking about fruit, are you going to put an orange there, a pomegranate? No. So what is the fruit?
Fruit is him, his
writing.
Being, his soul.
Yeah. Yeah, it's those who are produced, who grow
from this,
as a result of,
yes,
of the inspiration in those words.
Yeah.
That's who that is. As people, souls of individuals, are to be placed on your seat of honor. Well, whose seat of honor?
Dode's.
Dode's. And why would it be Dode's seat of honor? Because he was the son of God. Because God was his father. Because he was right. Because he was the great lyricist and singer of Israel. Because he was Yahweh's anointed. If your children continue to actually observe my covenant and my enduring testimony, by referencing this, I will teach them how to respond appropriately, as well as their children, with them always and forever, living and remaining in proximity to your seat of honor.
That promise.
So he's talking about now the fruit of Dode, which would be the fruit that he, that his words, his lyrics produce, being children. If they, what? What is God? There's only
actually
one caveat here. If they continue to what? Obey?
No.
If they continue to acquiesce, if they continue to believe. Whoever believeth in him. No, it doesn't say believe.
Or bow down.
It doesn't say bow down. It doesn't say worship. It doesn't say pray. It doesn't say submit. It says observe. Closely examine and carefully consider. If your children shall continue to observe, continue because it's written in the imperfect.
Ongoing, yeah.
And what is he saying you need to observe? What is it that is the most important thing to observe if you want to live in proximity to a Dode's seat of honor?
His covenant.
The bereft, the covenant. And where would one find the covenant presented?
The Torah, the prophets, and Dode's writings.
Correct. And the first place is presented where it tells us all five of the conditions, all five of the benefits, and the relationship is developed in a walk through human history is Bereshit, first book of the Torah. That is the dominant story of Bereshit. It's hard to miss. So you don't even have to get very far into the Torah to check off this one. And if you're children, that'd be the offspring of Dode's Mizmor. Continue to actually observe my covenant, my family-oriented relationship, and my enduring testimony, my eduth, ani, my restoring witness and evidence that I've repeatedly provided. By referencing this, I will teach them how to respond appropriately. So Yahweh says, I'm going to teach you how to respond appropriately by your belief, by your prayers, by going to church. No. By being open to the leading of the Spirit. By trying to discern God's will for your life. By becoming an ordained minister. No! By referencing this. Referencing this what? By referencing what one can observe relative to the covenant and what one can observe relative to Yahweh's enduring testimony. By referencing them, I will teach them how to respond appropriately. You know, we've been, and JB, I think you started with him. The guy, is it David's his name?
Yes.
That wrote, and he was, had his religion taken from him by questioning Paul. And then started on yada yada, but he's very desirous of presenting his interpretations of the Christian New Testament and of Greek and of his Jesus Christ and the like. He's having a tough time getting anybody to engage because nobody wants to even waste any time listening to his opinions on the Greek text, the Christian New Testament, Jesus Christ, or Aramaic, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're all just basically, don't get it. Why are you so fixated on trying to get to know God through Jesus? You'll never, ever, under any circumstances, come to know Yahweh via Yahusha. But I can tell you for absolute certain that if you come to know Yahweh, you'll know all you need to know about Yahusha.
Oh, yeah. That's what I was trying to explain to him. And I think he's coming around, and I think there's a chance. He's very new. He's coming, you know, I'm trying to be patient with him and give him, you know, try to kind of stair-step him through. And that's why I told him to read the book. I'm like, all the questions you have, well, I can answer that question, but it's just going to raise 10 more. And then we're going to go down this spiral. I'm like, if you read the books, it takes you through it step by step. So that we're
going to be really patient because the guy really wants to present himself as a smart guy that can think his way through Greek and history and that sort of thing. And he says, you know, it seems to me that, you know, that he had to do this, that, and the other thing. And you just go, oh, God. You know, somewhere along the range of the road, you're really going to drop this and just. Yeah, and the reason I bring this up is what does this say? By referencing this. By continuing to observe the covenant. The covenant is not presented in the Christian New Testament.
No, it's not. It's not ever.
No, it's not there. There is a single term or condition of the covenant presented in the Christian New Testament. Not there. That's not the purpose. And this, you know, this notion that if Yoshua is supposed to be, he gets his name all twisted, but if Yoshua is supposed to be the Word of God, then isn't it essential that we know those words?
Well, no. We quoted them in the Torah.
No, it's not in Israel, so we know what Yoshua said. If it was, we'd be screwed, blued, and tattooed. Because we don't know what he said.
Yes.
You know, the Christian New Testament is written in Greek. He didn't speak Greek. He spoke Hebrew. And there's not a single word memorialized for it in Hebrew. And the words that are in Greek are so butchered. You only got two texts that were written by eyewitnesses. The other two are hearsay.
Mm-hmm. One of them's Paul's friend.
Yeah. And one of the two that was written by friends. Right. Well, Luke, he doesn't claim to be inspired. He's just writing a letter to a friend. That's all it is, a letter written to a friend. There is no indication whatsoever of inspiration. There's no indication of inspiration in Marcus, in Mark.
And there's no claim of it either. That's the thing.
Neither of those men ever
claimed to be inspired or writing the Word of God. When did Yahu Khanan ever claim to be writing the Word of God? Outside of Revelation, Yahu Khanan never claimed that.
They're both Romans.
They were.
Well, one was probably Greek, the other was Roman. They weren't Yahudim. The prophets of Yahweh are all Yahudim. They can't. And then you've got Yahu Khanan, and you got two problems with Yahu Khanan's text. Three. One. No indication whatsoever that Yahu Khanan would have been fluent in and written in Greek. Number two, very little of Yahu Khanan speaks of the life of Yoshua. About 90% of it is what happened post the fulfillment of Pesach and Matzah, before the fulfillment.
Which the history is interesting, but has nothing to do with the Word of God.
Right. It was the path that was, you know, really, really fascinating to Yahu Khanan, because Yahu Khanan finally got it at that point. And you've got the other issue, which is that the most repeated, the most told story in it, the adulteress writing in the sand, and he was the first, without sin, cast the first stone, never occurred. And the oldest extant text of that is 8th century. You know, if the words of Yoshua were important for us to know, we would have a way of knowing them. I mean, really, all we have is Manya. Let's just get right down to it. What we have is Manya. And what we find is that Yoshua says very little of anything that isn't already in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, so it doesn't matter. You just don't need anything more. So this says that by referencing the story of the covenant, my covenant, the covenant is only presented, really in terms of, the covenant is referenced in many places, but the covenant presented so that you can understand it and act upon it and benefit from it is presented in one place, right at the beginning. You know, God says, you know, I created the universe, proves it. He goes right into the flood, explains the purpose of it. And there he goes, right into the covenant. I mean, it's right after, hello, here's who I am and what I have done. And let me tell you why.
I was like, my first email back to David was, he was talking about trying to, yeah, after dismissing Paul, trying to reconcile the rest of the quote-unquote Gospels. And I was like, you know, that's not the best place to start. Why don't you start, you know, where God said to start? Ba-Rashi, in the beginning. Yeah,
right.
How do you come in 80% of the way into the book and hope to understand what's going on?
Right. That's what this says. If your children will continue to observe, closely examine, and carefully consider the covenant and my enduring testimony, Yahweh's enduring testimony, Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, full stop. By referencing this, I will teach you how to respond appropriately. If you want to be taught by God how to respond appropriately to Him, observe what He has to say about the covenant and His enduring testimony. Straightforward. You know, there is no way any human being can refute that. Sure as hell doesn't say read Paul's letters. Sure as hell doesn't say praying without ceasing. Sure as hell doesn't say believe. No. Study. Observe. What should you be observing? The covenant and Yah's testimony. Period.
If Yah was saying,
if you do that, Yah was going to teach you how to respond appropriately. The covenant teaches you how to respond appropriately. It lays out five terms and conditions. Yeah. You know, Yahweh's enduring testimony begins in a book called the Torah, which means teaching.
Yahweh.
As well as their children, with them always and forever, living and remaining upon and in proximity to your seat of honor.
That's a wowie. Sorry.
Yeah. And it's David's seat of honor. Why would David's seat of honor be relevant here?
Because he's returning to restore his kingdom. This is his.
Well, that's important. Sure. Well, sure. That's the for 1,000 years. That's going to be important. And by the way, he's going to establish his kingdom forever. So the kingdom of Dode's interactions with us are going to continue for all eternity. Oh, a good thing. You know, that's the ultimate thing. But why is Dode's seat of honor important? Because Dode was Tzedak, right? Correct. Because Dode was Yahweh's son. And that's what it's all about. When you're going to be, that means that Yahweh's son has a seat of honor. And Yahweh was Dode's father. So the seat of honor is the seat that would be given to a favored son. The seat next to the father. The statement not only presents the purpose of the covenant, which is to be empowered by God and to be authorized to live next to his beloved son, Dode, for all time. It explains the purpose of Yahweh's testimony while affirming the reason that we should closely examine and carefully consider it. By observing Yahweh's Beirat, family relationship agreement, and his Eduth, his enduring testimony and restoring witness, consisting of evidence God has repeatedly provided in his Torah, our Heavenly Father, Lamad, will teach us how to respond appropriately, providing the information and instructions which enable us to accept the terms and conditions of the covenant and receive its benefits. That's all that matters. If we learn nothing more from the conclusion of this chapter and venture into the 132nd Mizmor, we have been richly rewarded just with that statement. If we observe, he will teach. But when you observe like this, you are going to stumble across some very, very unpopular things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Dode is Yahweh's anointed. Like, Dode is the guy with the seat of honor next to Yahweh. That we're invited to sit next to Dode. That the thing that will seal the deal for us, that will cause us to be near and with Yahweh for all time, is to be observant. And to observe the covenant. And Yahweh's restoring testimony. That's profound. And of course, it's completely contrary to all religion. And that Yahweh says, if you do that, I will teach you. Well, that is exactly what's happened to all of us. We began to closely examine and carefully consider the words he laid out regarding his covenant, his family relationship, and his enduring witness, and he taught us along the way, guided us along the way. For Yahweh, not Yosha, not Jesus, not Allah, not Buddha, not George Washington and Tommy Jefferson, not the Trumpster. For Yahweh has chosen and prefers Zion. Now think of this, where this just came out of. He just said, observe, closely examine, carefully consider the covenant, the family relationship, and my enduring testimony. And if you do so, by referencing them, I will teach you what you need to respond. And then he says, for Yahweh has chosen and prefers Zion. Well, is that just an odd lack of transition where you've just got a complete breach in that one statement is unrelated to the other they appear to be? Or is Yahweh's preference for Zion part and parcel of observing his covenant and his enduring testimony?
Well, this is his favorite place.
I mean, right.
It leads us to, signposts along the way lead us to Yahweh. So it's all part of
it. If you're going to observe the covenant, what you're going to find is that Dode's house is right next to Yahweh's house. That's what you're going to find.
Yes.
And you're going to find that Dode, through his lyrics, provided the signs to get from one to the other. And if you study and examine Yahweh's enduring witness, what you're going to find is the signs that he posted along the way in the midst of that on Moriah, and they're called Zion. So, Yahweh is saying, this is what I choose. This is what I prefer. Just a suggestion here. If you want to be in Yah's inner circle, you want to be chosen by him, then it's a really good idea to like what he likes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this fellow that we were talking about, J.B., one of the things he wrote earlier says, I've been praying to Jesus. You know, is it okay if I continue to pray to Jesus? And I wrote him back. I said, why would you be doing that? Why would you do that? What's the purpose of that? Do you think for some reason, you know, I didn't say this, but just as you're presenting your insights and your thoughts to us, which we don't care about, you know, we'd love for you to drop all that religious stuff. Change your perspective.
Yeah,
and fall in love with Yahweh's teaching. We would love for you to do so. We'll be a bit patient to help you get in that position. But why do you think that talking to God is somehow going to be a benefit? I mean, hey, Kirk, you're a pretty good guy.
I'm listening to
him. Do you think you've got anything to say that's going to be helpful to Yahweh to know?
No.
Jimmy, you did a really nice job of writing a book on circumcision. Circumcision, the sign of the covenant.
Yeah.
Do you have any insights that you would like to share with us that you think would be a benefit to Yahweh?
No. All my insights came from him.
There you go. And how did you get your insights from him?
Through his Torah and his prophets and...
You listened to what he had to say?
Writing Dode.
Yeah. You listened to what he had to say, right?
I am in carefully.
Shabbat.
Okay. You're a pretty bright dude. I mean, you're a technologist, pretty bright dude, JB?
Yeah, he is.
Smarter than the average guy? Logical?
I don't know about
rational.
Smart,
rational.
Logical and rational.
I asked Patty. She thought you were really smart and rational. Yeah, smart, rational. Maybe you're a smart, rational guy. Right? Is Yawa smarter?
Oh, yeah. By far.
Yeah. So
like you.
Yeah, so wouldn't it make sense for the smarter of the two to be the source of information in a conversation?
Yeah.
That doesn't mean we never talk together. I think that the way the conversation ought to be is that we ought to do something that I did today. For example, we were talking about the Yashika 17, and I've been translating and writing the insights derived from the words. So I think it really makes a lot of sense to listen to what we have to say. Observe it, think about it, ponder it, draw whatever insights you can from it, and then write those things down and share them. And if you're sharing the insights that you've gleaned from what he had to say, what you're indeed saying is, I paid attention to what you had to say. I observed it carefully, examined it, considered it, and this is what I found. Wow, this is, like I found that Sheol really is a black hole. Thanks for telling me. Thanks for affirming that. It's our response, our enthusiasm when we see an insight that's affirming or enlightening. It's our response.
I asked
this fellow, I said, so, at this point, you've made no attempt to listen to what Yahweh has to say, and yet you want him to listen to you. Isn't that maybe just a touch arrogant? Shouldn't maybe we start with listening to what he has to say, and then once we know what he has to say, maybe then we could yabber on and hope that he might be interested in what we have to say? Personally, guys, I don't think Yahweh is interested in anything that I have to say unless what I have to say helps his people understand what he had to say.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that we talk about what he said in a way that helps his children understand it, then he cares what we're talking about. I'm not sure he's listening to what we're talking about so much, but he's certainly pleased what we're talking about. So for indeed, Yahweh has chosen and prefers Zion. He has desired and marked out a dwelling place for the members of his household. Well, that's important. So what he's saying is that by observing the covenant, by observing his enduring testimony, that he can teach us how to respond appropriately. And that part and parcel of that is recognizing that Yahweh prefers Zion. Why? Because it marks out the dwelling place for the members of his household. What do you got there? Doe's house? Yahweh's house. Yahweh's house isn't for Yahweh to live. Do you think that God will fit into his house?
No.
On Mount Moriah? Will God fit on this planet?
No.
Will God fit in this universe, which is, probably 30 billion light years across?
Right now.
No. He won't fit. By the way, just speaking of fitting, I came up with an idea. I was having a discussion with a friend yesterday. I never thought of this before. It was really reassuring that when I thought of it. Okay. When we're in eternity with Yahweh, and we want to go out and explore the new universe that he creates for us, which will be a six-dimensional universe. He cannot create a seven-dimensional universe. Even God cannot create a seven-dimensional universe. Can't do it.
No, it's in it.
But the universe he's going to create can be a sixth dimension. And we go out there and we're now liberated in time. We understand how the fourth dimension intersects the three and now can actually maneuver in and be a part of six and seven. But we have been in the seventh dimension with Yahweh. We've been empowered. We've been enriched. We've been perfected. We've been made immortal. And now we want to journey out of the seventh dimension and go and explore the universe. How are we going to do that?
We have to diminish ourselves.
Oh, yeah. Bingo. But not just diminish ourselves. We have to do something before we even diminish ourselves. Yahweh can't. Can Yahweh diminish himself and enter this world?
Well, he has. He set up our spirit.
Well, be careful. Be careful.
You're a part of it.
No. The Ruach Kodesh is not a diminished aspect of Yahweh. The Ruach Kodesh is an aspect of Yahweh that's set apart from him.
Okay.
Which means that the overwhelming preponderance of Yahweh, 99.99999% of Yahweh, remains in the seventh dimension when he uses this portion that is set apart to interact with us, the set apart spirit.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, when this is the thought, and I had never, because I was always wondering, how in the world are we going to exist in the exploring these six dimensions, while then coming back and celebrating the festival feasts and the Shabbat and our relationship with Yahweh in the seventh dimension? How are we going to do that? The answer is really simple. The preponderance of us is never going to leave the seventh dimension. We're going to set apart part of ourselves to explore the universe. And that part of ourselves, now, there is no big deal with us taking a tiny aspect of ourselves and transitioning us, diminishing us, that aspect of ourselves, from energy to matter.
Well, that's like him, that would make sense.
Yeah, exactly. And so when we're out enjoying the warmth of a star,
mm-hmm.
we're out smelling the fragrance of the flowers, we're out observing the phenomenon of life, good food, good wine, good companionship, maybe even love. Out there in the six-dimensional universe, then we still have the majority of ourselves in Yahweh's presence in Shamayim, in the spiritual world. So we're going to be capable of enjoying it all through this aspect of ourselves, which is set apart and then diminished. For me, that's really comforting. And one of the reasons it's comforting, let's say that we're out there and we decide that we're going to follow Kirk, and Kirk gets really enamored by this source of light that's over the horizon, and we find that source of light is a volcano, and it spews out a bunch of lava, and we're in mortal, or, you know, the physical form, and we get turned into a pillar of ash. So what happens to us?
You're still hanging around. Kirk.
Nothing. Nothing. You know, if you were to take a seven-dimensional construct and set apart part of it and diminish it so that it could explore six dimensions, how much of you have you lost? When you realize that eight-dimensional move up the dimensional chains is infinite.
Yeah, plus you're always growing.
Nothing.
Well, we're learning not to get close to the volcano, regardless.
Yeah, we're just not going to follow Kirk into the volcano. That's just all there is to it.
So I'm not a leader.
Right. So what Zion here represents is that Yahweh's marking out the dwelling place for the members of his household.
Mm-hmm.
He's defined Zion here. That's the purpose of it. It takes us to his home, his covenant home. It's in context here. He's talking about his covenant home and his enduring testimony, and he says that the path that Yahweh prefers is Zion. It's the one that he's marked out to the dwelling place for the members of his household, which would be the covenant family. You want to enter the covenant family? Follow Yahweh's preferred route, which is up Zion. Pretty nice definition of Zion, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
And is it, this is my resting place. This is the place that I intend to occupy, free of oppression, a place that to compose one's thoughts when the work is done. From Nuach, where the Ruach spirit abides and remains settling down to provide rest. So this is my resting place until a distant future time. Ad. As far as and up to the extent of my witness in the foreseeable future. Here in this place, I will abide and remain because I desire it. What in the hell is man doing in Mecca and the Vatican and Washington, D.C.? And pretending those are places where God is present. And he's made it really clear. The place that he's going to be, the place that he prefers, the place that he's going to endure for a very long period of time, Ad, is Zion. There's only one Zion. The ridge line of Moriah. It goes from Dod's house to Yahweh's house. If you want to find Yahweh, you better walk along the signs that he posted along the way, Zion, on Moriah. If you're following a different path, you ain't going to God. That's what he said here. Unless you're following that path, you are not, you're going in a direction where God is not. If you're focused on Mecca, or the Vatican, or Rome, or Washington, or London, or Paris, or Berlin, or Moscow, or any of these places, I'm sorry, but you're headed away from God. Only one path leads to Yahweh, according to Yahweh's testimony, Zion. So all those that want to bad-mouth Zionists because they don't want to sound racist because racism is in opposition to their mantra, but they hate Jews, so they say, no, we just hate Zionists. Well, if you hate Zionists, you hate God.
Yeah.
Be really careful about that. And Yahweh twice here says, because I desire it, I yearn for it, this is what I want. I'm enthralled by it. How many of these Nimrod Christians out there say, I'm doing the will of God? Well, what is the will of God?
For you to
meet the covenant family on Zion.
Yeah.
Yeah, to meet the covenant family on Zion. If you're not helping direct children to the covenant, men and women to the covenant, in association with Zion, then you are not doing God's will.
That's right.
Yeah.
Did you, interesting point, may I?
Yeah.
If you look at Dod's name, it doesn't matter which direction you approach Dod from, it leads you to peace up the earth to be increased.
Correct.
So, I mean, it's something where he says the same thing over and over and over again. This is the path.
Right. Yeah, it does not matter which way you approach it. It's always the same.
It's like Haya, you know, to exist. The same type of thing, yeah.
Yeah, Haya. Yeah, Dod and Haya, the same thing. And, you know, one of the things that I learned very late in this, but, you know, a couple of months ago, is Yahud, which is the basis of Yahudah and Yahudim, isn't as I had suspected. It isn't. Relates to Yah and related to Yah. It is beloved of Yah. It's based on a combination of Yahweh and Dod. Yahud is beloved of Yah. the name of God's single most important place and people is based on a compound of Yahweh and Dod.
Now, that's a biggie.
That's a biggie. The basis of this word, which is Yahud, the basis of a place called Judah, Yahudah, the place and the people dearest to Yahweh, is a compound of Yahweh's name and Dod's name. Now, for all you that want to continue to promote this myth that Jesus is either the third person of the Trinity, or that Jesus is the anointed Messiah, or that Jesus is the one who's the most important, or that Jesus is the principal, or Yahusha is the principal branch. I'm sorry. But he did not name his people or his favorite place Yahweh Yahusha. I mean, come on. What Yahusha means is Yahweh liberates and saves.
Yeah.
That means it's a job description. Recognize it as that. You know, at the very best, Yahusha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. So why would you look at the diminished manifestation when you can come to know Yahweh directly?
Real thing.
Why would you do that? Now, Dod's a different story, because what Dod does is Dod is the example of Yahweh doing what he chooses to do as well as it can be done, which is, you look at Moshe going into Egypt. God could have gone in there and dealt with Pharaoh on his own. He chose not to. He wants to work through people. Flawed, passionate people. You think Yahweh could have built the boat and got two of each animal aboard? Do you think he needed Noah to help him build the boat?
Hardly.
I don't think. Do you think he needed Moshe to help scribe the Torah? He thinks not. Do you really think that he needed Yirmiyah or Yashiyah to help him with his prophecies?
He desires it.
No.
He desires it.
Yahweh wants to work through his creation. He wants to engage with his creation. That's the reason there is creation. And so, since Yahusha is Yahweh's soul, and therefore a diminished manifestation of Yahweh set apart from Yahweh, Yahusha is not Yahweh working through his creation.
No.
And therefore it's not the prime directive.
No.
Dod is the prime directive. Yahweh working through his creation. That's what he wants. So I will kneel down in love to lift up her fortifications and provisions, supplementing the food supply by providing a pleasant change in the menu, completely satisfying those among her who are open and receptive to the feast. Lakem speaks of bread, which is particularly nourishing. I happen to know a feast that's based on bread.
Mm-hmm. Called matzah?
Yeah. Unyeasted bread, matzah. And the feast of unyeasted bread incorporates 3 days. Pesach, matzah, and Bikurim. And if you just understood that 3-day event, the feast of bread, if you will, and you know the doorway to life, you know the means to perfection, and the ability to be, the offer to be adopted. You have it all.
Okay.
Right there. So he's going to completely satisfy those who are open and receptive to the feast.
Yeah.
If you're receptive to the feast, Yahweh is going to shabuah you, enrich and empower you. If you're open to the feast and you answer that invitation, you're already going to become immortal, perfected, and adopted into his family. So He kneels down to love, to lift up his children. Supplementing their food, providing a pleasant change of menu, completely satisfying those who are open and receptive. Boy, that's the key.
Yeah, boy, really.
Right, open to the discipline of Yah. I'm receptive to it. That's 132.15. Also, I will clothe and array her ministers with salvation, and those who are devoted to her will rejoice, singing joyfully. 132.16. You know, we have to be careful that we look at religious dress-up with disdain.
Mm-hmm.
This is not saying that, boy, I'm going to make certain that the priests, those ministers, are going to be really looking sharp. This isn't them choosing what they're going to wear. This isn't religious dress-up. You know, it says I'm going to clothe them and aware and adorn them, if you will, array them who are devoted, such that they're arrayed with salvation, with freedom, with deliverance, with liberation, with liberty. There's two things that are important here. What we want to be clothed in, if you will, to be arrayed in, is what's important to Yahweh. And Yasha, which is Yesha, really, which is typically translated salvation, is actually not the primary meaning of the word. Primary meaning of the word is not to save, it's to liberate. It is to provide freedom. It's to deliver. Liberty is Yasha. Now, why do you think that the primary meaning of Yasha is to liberate rather than to save?
Well, that goes back to the Yobel. This is when we're set free from all this.
Correct. Yeah, because by being liberated from the edicts of man, religion and politics, militarism and the like,
total separation,
and being free to be perfected by God, to know Yahweh, to engage in a relationship with Yahweh, we are liberated and free. Free of our sins, free of religion, free of politics, free of human corruption, free no longer to have to obey and submit to some human institution. We're liberated. Freedom.
Yeah, that's something to sing about, right?
Oh, you know, it just crossed my mind. I told you, Kirk, at the beginning of the show, some of the just preposterous things my ex has written.
Yes, sir.
And told others. I mean, it's just, you just shake your head and say, how could anybody be that delusional, that paranoid, that disgusting? Nonetheless, she has been. By divorcing her, I'm liberated from that, though. I spent 30 years being abused by that emasculating, debilitating kind of make-believe and slander. And I wasn't saved from it. I was liberated from it. And that's what Yahweh is offering, to be liberated from the lies, the distortions, the paranoia, the delusions of man.
Mm-hmm.
Being liberated from it, being freed from it.
Excellent point.
Yeah. I never really liked that term, saved. Because it's all about that heaven-hell thing. You're saved from hell, and that's the emphasis. Yeah.
Liberated is freedom.
To what?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, when I was pregnant, we were talking about what we're going to eat, and one of the things that we ate was crab claws.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think crab is on considered food list. It's probably on the not considered food list, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But in the Devarim, it says, you know, eat whatever you want so long as you eat
it aware.
Thoughtfully. Right.
Yeah,
and
right.
So I bring this up because I view everything from the point of view that we have been liberated. And that means even our minds have been freed to understand what these things represent. We are not obligated to perform a certain way. It's not religion. We've been liberated to live our lives freely, thoughtfully, powerfully. Being liberated is, oh, wow. We've been liberated from death. We've been liberated from our sins. We have been liberated from the fears and delusions and all of the horrible things that men and women have concocted. To be liberated, to be freed, that's the gift.
Well, you know,
free to walk out of this world into Yahweh's home, that's the gift.
Yeah, talking about being
explore the universe with him.
You've heard the phrase "out of the fire pan into the fire." You were saved from the frying pan, but what does that matter if you're in the fire?
Right there. Yeah.
If you're liberated, there's a complete difference.
Yeah.
The emphasis on being saved, but saved to what? Yeah, I don't want to be saved to the Christian heaven. That'd be hell to me.
Right. When Yahweh introduces himself to us in the first statement that he etched in stone, what he says, I'm the one that freed you from the crucibles of human oppression, religion, and politics. That's where we're being liberated from.
Yeah.
That's why the liberation aspects of Yahshua are so important. Because once you're liberated from those things, you are now in a position where you can use your newfound freedom to go where the words lead, to observe the covenant, to follow that path of Zion.
And
those who are devoted, go ahead, Kirk.
No, I was just going to say, we just finished reading where he said, if you'll do that, then I will help you. I'll help you to understand. I'll help you to.
Right.
And he'll educate you, and he's going to lift you up, and he just said, I'm going to lift you up, too. So, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, what else do you want?
Right. That's right. And those who are devoted in her, well, what's her here? Got to go back to the covenant, right? Or the Yahweh's restoring testimony. Those who are devoted in her will rejoice, singing joyfully. It's a happy place. I think that when, if I first tell people, because I meet a lot of new people, that Pauline Christianity is just a pile of lies. Islam is just a pile of deadly lies. And that Judaism is a pile of lies. God hates religion. And there really is a God. And then you say, I've come to know him because I've translated the Dead Sea Scrolls out of ancient Hebrew into English. And they say, oh, God, another religious wacko here, And you almost sense that's going to be the first response. And you say, no. So what I found there is that there really is a God. He proves his existence, and he's one cool dude. He's fun. He's a joy to be around.
Not a party pooper.
Right. And what you find is that what he has to say is uplifting. It's liberating. It's enriching. It's empowering. It's every good thing you could imagine. And so the more you know about who he is and what he said and what he's offering, what he expects in return, the more we will rejoice. We'll be exuberant. We'll be happy. This is happy news. Now, we turn to this, Ms. Moore, and I'm sure this is also going to be the next chapter, too, because we were trying to figure out what the branch represented.
Mm-hmm.
Shishmak. Who was the branch? What did the branch represent? And our original goal was just to better define Shishmak. and we're about to encounter it again. This time as the verb, as shabak. It comes to the conclusion of the song. And while it does not comfortably align with either the idea of a branch or a plant flourishing, it once again speaks of growth, something Yahweh cares passionately about. Further, is once again associated with Dod, and perhaps Yosha, even with anointing and leaving us enlightened while hedging upon a definitive answer. It reads, this is 132:17. Here is where, Zion. Here is where I will enable growth from the source of the radiant light on behalf of Dod. I have prepared and arranged a lamp, a luminary, an anointed, or for my anointed. For my anointed. Well, who's his anointed? Who's speaking here?
Dod. You said so.
No, who's speaking here? Here is where I will enable growth from the source of radiant light on behalf of Dod. I have prepared and arranged a lamp, a luminary, for my anointed. Who's speaking? Who said my? Yahweh
did.
So who did Yahweh call his anointed?
Dod again.
Dod. He's not calling Yosha his anointed. Dod. Dod is the example. Dod is the person Yahweh chose to convey everything we need to know. He worked through Dod to enlighten us. I created the universe for Dod. We're the beneficiaries. Yeah, and boy, do I ever like that. Boy, have I ever had my Dodian moments. And then, when I say I've had my Dodian moments, if I'm 1/1,000,000,000th of Dod in any one of these things, that's cool with me. But I've had my moments where my words were like lyrics to songs that Yah was inspiring. Just by learning what he had to say. There are moments where the insights derived from his words are stunningly spectacular. Dodian moment. There's times where there are realizations gleaned from the Torah and prophets and the Psalms that no one has even thought about in over 2,000 years. Those are Dodian moments. But like Dod, I also celebrate life. I live life to the fullest. Dod loved love. Dod loved learning. Dod loved life. And so, to have this guy that had flaws and wrinkles but passion and brilliant insights, and to recognize that's the guy that Yahweh said correct, man, it liberates us. Rather than feeling like, all those rabbis that are bobbing up and down at the wall and say, woe is us, boy, we have disappointed our God, woe is us, we're such scum. No, what Dod is saying is, gosh, life is great, isn't it? It was cool, we have a great relationship, and I just love the things I'm learning from him. And I'm going to share them with you. That's the guy. It's just... to show how the Torah perfects, Yahweh chose someone who was imperfect and yet right. So he is going to enable growth from the source, from Zion, of the radiant light, which will be his home at the top, on behalf of Dod. So which means that on behalf of Kirk and JB and me and all of you who are listening, everyone, he is doing this on our behalf. Because Dod, there's a little of Dod in all of us. And my friend down under, Dode, that lives in New Zealand. You know, one of my very favorite guys. I can't wait to eternity and be able to hang out with him. And, you know, he has so many interesting insights as to what he thinks eternity is going to be like. And I think it's going to be a celebration of the things that Dode celebrates, which makes it really rich and interesting. So he has prepared a luminary, a lamp. He says, I have prepared and arranged a lamp for my anointed. Now, I can't tell you if this lamp is a menorah, demonstrating the 6+1 and how that relates to us and to time and to the plan of coming home. I can't tell you if it's a brilliant light that we can use to shine on Yahweh's testimony so that we understand it and become enlightened. I don't know if it's this huge flashlight, if you will, to shine on Zion so people can see the signs that are posted along the way.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the set apart spirit providing this beautiful illumination that covers up all of the flaws so that Yahweh only sees that which is pure and beautiful and done. And maybe I know. Because maybe it's all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
That the luminary is this brilliant light to shine on Yah's word so we're all enlightened by it. That this luminary lights up the signs that Yah posted along the way. That this luminary floods us with light so there are no dark recesses where everything is perfect. That this luminary transforms us into light where we are perfected and immortal, empowered. It's the guide. You know, the guide along the way, got to have a flashlight.
Right. Light your path.
And all of those things. 132:17. So what we find in this particular case is that Shamak is a source of growth. Here is where I will enable. Now you could say, okay, the branch of radiant light. But it makes much more sense. I will enable growth from the source. I will produce vibrant and abundant life, branching out and growing, enhancing the shining influence of the radiant light. So the direct read here, by the way, is that Dode is providing, Yahweh is providing for Dode a lamp to illuminate the signs he has posted along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that lamp could, in fact, be related to Mashiach. How? Mashiach is being anointed with olive oil.
Olive oil.
The lamp that Yahweh is providing.
Mm-hmm.
The source of the light would be olive oil.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's a direct correlation between being anointed and Yahweh arranging a lamp, a luminary. Because all of the luminaries at that time burned olive oil. They're one and the same. So Shamak here speaks of growth, something essential to life. Growth is required to be infinite, and thus to being God as we know Him. Growth is near and dear to Yahweh's heart, demonstrated by the fact that it is the purpose of Shavuah, where the covenant's children are enriched, empowered, and enlightened, growing exponentially where it matters most. In our own world, growth has its limitations. We grow up and then we grow old. Our days are limited. In our youth, we gain knowledge through new experiences, but as we age, our eyesight and hearing deteriorate, as does our cognitive ability. With time, most of us lose mobility. But with Yahweh, and part of our transformation from physical to spiritual beings, growing as we will from 3 dimensions to 7, our increased capability will be infinite. we will shamak in every conceivable way, as will our Father. Truly an amazing thought, and what a wonderful way to conclude the first chapter of the second volume of Yashaya, or the second volume of Observations of Our Time, as we're studying Yashaya and going on journeys into words like Shemak along the way to help understand everything that God is conveying through his prophet Yashaya. So, JB, I think that that Kirk fell off the planet there for a minute. I've just got to notice that he had dropped. I hope there's nothing.
Seems to have dropped.
Yeah, going on there. And we've come to the end of the broadcast portion of the program anyway. And
lined up perfectly at the end of the chapter.
Yeah, it's right there at the end of the chapter. And so what we really need to decide, and I'll send the text to you this week, JB, on Yashaya 17. We can decide, do we want to go there? Yeah, just kind of see what is in store, because almost all of our attention is focused on what Yahweh has to say about the covenant, his testimony, and how we become part of his covenant family, and what he wishes that we walk away from so that we can journey to know him and benefit from what he has to offer. We don't spend an enormous amount of time on future events as they're laid out in the Torah and prophets. For us, it's an interesting curiosity, and it's something we should probably talk a little more about, because it's a huge attraction to many. Now, I don't think it's kind of interesting here. All of these books, all of these shows, while we're delighted that Goyim have benefited from them, they've never been the intended audience. The intended audience is Yahudim and Israel. Yeah, and I have never sensed, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but I've never sensed that Yahudim and Israelites are as fascinated by prophecy as have been Christians. Now, Christians don't have a clue, because they don't understand God's timeline, and they don't understand how it works in this transition from matter to energy. And they get caught up in the stupidity of God dying and the stupidity of a bodily resurrection. And they can't get out of their own shadow, and they have no appreciation for how everything that Yahweh does is based upon the 6+1 and how it's all integrated over time in the fulfillment of his Moed Mikra. They got no clue, but they're fixated on it. Just clueless.
Well, I think that comes back to the whole faith concept. They're looking for something to justify their faith. So if they have
that they can point to,
that reassures them and gives them security in their faith.
Right. But Yehudim, Israel, I just never sense that most Israelites are fascinated by prophecy as others have been. And so in writing this, I have spent most of our time in prophecy past rather than prophecy future. And that's a concept very few people appreciate anyway. And in my view, it's actually a more important prophetic revelation and affirmation is prophecy past than prophecy future.
That's definitely what I find more interesting.
Yes. How and when and why God created the universe. The how, when, and why of the flood. The how, when, and why of the Exodus and the revelation of the Torah. That's kind of stuff. The how, when, and why of his relationship with Abraham. That kind of stuff is really a lot more interesting and a lot more affirming than what's going to happen.
Well, there's a lot more to learn from it.
Correct. Because what's going to happen is really, really bad, folks. There's some pluses. There's some nice things that are said in 17 of Yahweh's children and how he is gleaning them from the top of the olive. Now, there's some nice things that are said. But I want to tell you, the time of Jacob's troubles, it's hellacious. It's hell on earth. You want to avoid it. It's why I was taking his children out. But so it's something that we really can't spend a lot of time with, other than things are going to get so bad for Israel that, and the United States in particular, where half the Jews in the world live, is going to get to be so disdained and hated by God that it's really important that that we do focus on some prophecy. And I think we've got it right in terms of the mix of past prophecy versus future prophecy as it relates to the target.
Well, especially with Isaiah and 17, you know, we're not just even talking about future prophecy. We're talking about fulfillment that's working right now. And in that regard, that's very important to point out, is just how this is saying this, and we're literally watching that happen. You know, turn on CNN, NBC, any of those. You know, look what's going on in the world, and we are witnessing this. Yeah, Isaiah 17 being fulfilled right now.
Correct.
That's not even necessarily future prophecy. That's like current events.
Current events.
That I find.
But with an eye towards what's going to happen over the next 10 years.
Yeah. And that's important because it is, you know, it adds a level of credibility that other, you know, people that might not get the historical stuff will see. And being seeing that there and going, wow, wait, maybe there is something here.
Yeah, my first pass through Isaiah 17 was among the most affirming things that I could ever recall reading, because it was telling us that what's happening now in Syria, what's happening now in throughout the the wars that are taking place and around Damascus, that all of that is the prelude to the end. And it tells us exactly when these events, what's going to happen with Damascus, what's going to happen with Syria, and as a result of that, what's going to happen to Israel, and then as a result of that, what it's going to trigger in terms of groups like Muslims to do, and how that's going to influence the world and generally and Israel specifically. It's all laid out for us. It's amazing. Anyhow, he didn't lay it out because he's looking for, you know, to predestine it. He's just telling this is future history. This is what you're gonna, this is what's going to happen. And even the stuff we're reading right before our eyes, even it, you've got to realize it was written 2,700 years ago. So, it is powerful.
It's something we can't ignore. Yeah, there's certain aspects, you know, trying to sit there and dig into Revelation and make conclusions based on that and draw a picture from that. That, to me, is something that's kind of not really necessarily worth our time. But something like Isaiah 17 is, like I said, we're watching it being fulfilled. To be able to sit there and point out to people, you know, this is what's happening now. This is what Yahweh told us was going to happen. This is what he told us was going to follow this. Yeah, and it's the credibility thing, not like your credibility, but the message's credibility. It builds
right.
The credibility of the message we're driving is by being able to point out this and be like, yeah, this is what you're seeing. This is what's going to come next. And then when that happens, it builds the credibility of the message. So you can't
correct.
Not address it.
Correct. That's correct. And it's essential that Israel and Yehuda know what's going to happen, because if they don't and they see really everything around them being destroyed, they're going to withdraw. You know, I was in a horrible relationship, and my response every time I was attacked was to withdraw. That's what's going to happen. They're going to continue to withdraw. And if they know that it's going to happen and why it's going to happen and what they can do to be withdrawn from it, then that's the answer they need. Because that's what the goal should be for everyone, is to be withdrawn from the time of Jacob's troubles. Not to endure it. And that's what I meant.
There's a reason y'all are
to hear
that prophecy.
Yeah.
You know, it exists.
So I'm delighted. It's really a fun thing to do. Maybe we'll go there beginning next week and then return to the second chapter of Observations for a Time. Anyway, thank you, JB. Kirk, sorry you got dropped off. All hope all is well with you. And Stephen, we hope you get better in a hurry. May God bless you. Well, happy
shot. Yes. Have a good shot.
Night.
Night.